This morning we'll be reading, passage will be on Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 1 to 29. However, I'll be reading from verse 1 to 20, if you would join me. This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Stand at the gate of the Lord's house and there proclaim this message. Hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah who come through these gates to worship the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal, and follow other gods you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house, which bears my name, and say, we are safe. Safe to do all these detestable things? Has this house, which bears my name, become a den of robbers to you? But I have been watching, declares the Lord. Go now to the place in Shiloh where I first made a dwelling for my name, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. While you were doing all these things, declares the Lord, I spoke to you again and again, but you did not listen. I called you, but you did not answer. Therefore, what I did to Shiloh, I will now do to the house that bears my name, the temple you trust in, the place I gave to you and your ancestors. I will thrust you from my presence, just as I did all your fellow Israelites, the people of Ephraim. So do not pray for this people, nor offer any petition for them. Do not plead with me, for I will not listen to you. Do you not see what they are doing in the towns of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem? The children gather wood, the fathers light the fire, and the women knead the dough and make cakes to offer to the Queen of Heaven. They pour out drink offerings to other gods to arouse my anger. But am I the one they are provoking, declares the Lord? Are they not rather harming themselves to their own shame? Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. My anger and my wrath will be poured out on this place, on man and beast, on the trees of the field and on the crops of your land, and it will burn and not be quenched.
Thank you, Tan. Well, when we lived in Southeast Asia, one of the greatest threats to my happiness came from the mosquito. Not only did it disturb my comfort, leaving me with these itchy bites all the time, not only did it disturb my sleep by buzzing around my ear through the night, it disturbed my thoughts. Because every time I got bit, I'd be wondering, will this lead to dengue fever? If you haven't heard about dengue fever, it's this mosquito-borne disease that leaves you weak and with rashes and with headaches, and it thins your blood and you have muscle aches. It's horrible. I got it when we were there, Anna got it when we were there, our son Liam got it once. And I can tell you, once you've had it, if the mosquito wasn't already public enemy number one, it is now. Well, in our early years living there, I would go into battle against the mosquito every night. I'd get the repellent and I'd lather it on. And Anna used to say, Derek, you shouldn't put that much on, it's bad for you. And I'd say, I don't care, love, I sacrifice all for this battle. And I'd put on the repellent and then I'd spray the whole room. And then we had this tennis racket-shaped zapper, and I'd be holding that in my left hand. And then with my right hand, I'd pull the bedsheet over the top, even though it was too hot for a bedsheet. These were all the measures I would take to protect myself. But then we increased our defence budget and we built a 4-poster bamboo frame and we draped mosquito nets all around the edge of our bed. And we created this zone of safety. And it was wonderful. We could put the repellent away, we could put the spray away, could put away the zapper, we could discard the bed sheet, and I could sleep in peace and safety. Until one night, I woke up in the middle of the night, it was around midnight, and I was insanely itchy. I turned on the lights and Anna said, "What are you doing, Derek?" And I said, "Quiet, love, there's something that's gone wrong with our defences." And I started to examine our zone of safety and I looked up and down every inch on the inside of the net. And sure enough, eventually, I found it, a mosquito inside. You see, I got more bites that night than on any of the pre-net nights. See, I thought I was safe, and so I hadn't taken any protective measures. I thought I was safe, but I wasn't. When you think about it, that's actually the most dangerous position of all to be in, isn't it? When you think you're safe, but you're not. When you think you're safe, and so you don't do anything about the problem. Of course, the problem that we're about to talk about now is infinitely more serious, infinitely more frightening than a dengue-bearing mosquito. The problem we're about to talk about now, the problem that Jeremiah foresees in this text, is the problem of the Almighty God coming to justly judge his people's sin. How much more serious, how much more terrifying if you think you're safe from that, but actually you're not. This is the position the Israelites are in Jeremiah chapter 7. They think they're safe from God's judgment, but they're not. And it's Jeremiah's job to warn them of that. So for me, it was the fortress of the bamboo and the netting which gave me that false sense of security. What was it for the Israelites? What had given them that false sense of security? It was religion. The Israelites, they're practicing their religion. They're turning up to the temple. They're performing the sacrifices, and they think that that makes them safe. Have a look at verse 10. Verse 10, they come to the temple and they say, "We are safe." Now contrast that with the actual situation in verse 20. "Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says, my wrath and my anger will be poured out on this place, on man and beast, on the trees of the field and on the crops of your land, and it will burn and not be quenched." They are not safe. God is angry. God's judgment is coming. But like me inside that mosquito net, they think they're safe. And so they're not vigilant. They're not alert. They're not doing anything at all to prevent this disaster from coming. It's the most dangerous position of all to be in. And the problem is, as we're going to see, is that the religion that they're practicing is false. It's a false religion. And so this text we're looking at today, Jeremiah 7, it's a warning about false religion. Now, there's all sorts of warning texts in Scripture, and they're all important, but I want to say that this one is especially important for us because of who it's addressed to. Who's that? Who's it addressed to? Have a look at verse 2. God says to Jeremiah, "Stand at the gate of the Lord's house." Stand at the temple. "And there proclaim this message." So can you picture this scene? People are filing into the temple area. They've come to worship. They're bringing their sacrifices. They're dressed in their Sabbath best. And they're doing what's expected of good, pious Israelites. Who's the Jeremiah 7 warning for? It's for religiously observant people. People who are doing what's expected of committed people of faith. People like us. This sermon was delivered today. Where would Jeremiah be standing? Would he be standing in the foyer of your church on a Sunday morning? would he be standing in the foyer of Weekly at 11:45 on a Wednesday? See, this warning is not one for the backslider. It's not one for the atheist. It's not one for the irreligious materialist out there. It's for us in here, religiously observant people. And it's to warn us about the real problem of false religion, the real problem of thinking we're safe when we're not. Now, the way that Jeremiah does this is by helping us to understand what makes false religion false, in order that we might see it, if it's there in our own lives, that we might see it and pursue change. Let's take a look. The question we'll be asking is, what makes false religion false? And we're going to find four answers from this text to that question. The first one is a false trust. A false trust in religious institutions. The Israelite worshippers have a motto. It's there in verse 4. Have a look. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. What's this motto mean? It means that they think that having the temple, that worshipping in the temple, makes them safe. After all, it's from God. It's God's good, holy gift to them. It's his house. So surely he wouldn't let anything happen to it. Surely its very presence makes them safe, right? Wrong. Verse 4 says that their trust is a false trust, and the words of that motto are deceptive words. Why? Because institutions like the temple by themselves don't guarantee anything. Institutions like this are God-given means for the Israelites to express their covenant relationship with God. But if the Israelites disregard the covenant, disregard the relationship with God, then those institutions, those means, become meaningless. Have a look at verse 5. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the foreigner, the fatherless or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors forever and ever. All of those if yous, if you A, if you B, if you C, they're all covenant obligations. God is saying, if you live out the covenant, if you commit yourselves to me and to my laws, then you will be safe. Then you can enjoy and benefit from all of those institutions, the temple and the land, all the things that I give you. But if you don't, then those institutions become meaningless, and they certainly don't guarantee your safety. Look at verse 8. He says, look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. False religion takes a good thing, a God-given thing, like the temple, and misuses it. Misuses it by putting confidence in it, trusting in it to do something that it was never intended to do. That's why it's a false trust, which produces a false religion. And it leaves the Israelites thinking that they're safe when actually they're in great spiritual danger. So might we ever do something like this? It won't be with the Jerusalem temple for us, but might we take an institution of our new covenant faith or a practice of our new covenant faith and put our trust in it to do something it was never intended to do? Might we put our trust in our practice of going to church as the thing that makes us safe? I go to church, I go to church, I go to church. Or in the institution we're a part of. I'm Presbyterian, Presbyterian, Presbyterian. Or even better, I'm at SMBC, SMBC, SMBC. Might we put our trust in our devotional habits as the thing that makes us safe? I did a quiet time today, a quiet time, a quiet time. Or in a sacrament. I've been baptized. I've been baptized. I've been baptized. Or in our robust theology, I'm a Reformed evangelical, a Reformed evangelical, a Reformed evangelical. Or in our ministry role, I'm a church planter, a church planter, a church planter. These things are all good things, wonderful things, God-given things, which if used rightly will help us to grow and mature and serve. But if they become objects of false trust, if we trust them to do what they were never meant to do, that is to make us safe, regardless of whether we're committing to the fullness of the covenant obligations in the relationship, if we trust them to do that, then we're on the road to false religion, turning good things, good gifts from God, into instruments of false religion. So what makes false religion false? That's the first thing. It's a false trust. Now the second thing, a false life. False religion reveals itself in a false life of disobedience and hypocrisy. Let's read from verse 9. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal and follow other gods you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house which bears my name and say, we are safe. Safe to do all these detestable things? How many of the Ten Commandments does God manage to squeeze into verse 9? Steal, murder, adultery, perjury, worship other gods. See, the problem here is disobedience, law breaking. Their false trust in the temple, which was point 1, is now fueling a false life, point 2. They've turned the temple into a MasterChef-style immunity badge. They think they can do whatever they like between temple visits, whatever stealing and murdering and Baal worship they like, and then in verse 10 they can turn up at the temple and say, we are safe, safe to do all those detestable things. And God says, no, you can't. That's hypocrisy. That's false religion. Temple attendance without all of life obedience is false religion. Religious observance without all of life obedience, false religion. What they're doing, according to verse 11, is that they're turning the temple into a den of robbers. Just think about that image for a moment. Robbers, they need a den, don't they? They need a hideout, somewhere that they can go after a heist where they won't be found by the authorities, where they'll be safe, where they can recharge and prepare for the next crime. This is what the Israelites have turned God's temple into. In false religion, that's what God's good gifts become, a place where lawbreakers think they can take refuge, where they think they're safe from the consequences of their sin. But again, God says, no. Verse 11, I have been watching. The police had set up surveillance on the robber's den. You wouldn't call it a safe haven, would you? And God's saying here, I've got my eye on this den. I know what you're doing. The Israelites have been living a false life. Religious observance without all of life obedience is false religion. So what about us? As I reflect on this, I find myself having a complex response. On the one hand, I'm repulsed. If you think about this image of a violent murderer turning up at the temple and saying, I'm safe, I can go away and do it all again. It's appalling, isn't it? It's hypocrisy. It's injustice. It's repulsive. But on the other hand, I can see me in that picture. I can see the potential for that same hypocritical pattern, that seamless transition from ungodly behavior to religious performance. I've seen it play out in my heart, in my life. And I suspect if you search your heart and life, you will too. Have you ever found yourself gossiping one moment and then leading a Bible study the next? Having lustful thoughts one moment, then standing up the front of church as the service leader welcoming the congregation the next. enraged because someone criticized you one moment, then delivering a sermon the next. Envying someone else's achievements one moment and then singing songs of praise in church the next. Speaking cutting words to someone one moment and then leading others in prayer the next. The truth is, we can be both repulsed by religious hypocrisy and capable of it at the same time. And Jeremiah 7 here is here to warn us that that way lies false religion. Our question is, what makes false religion false? So far we've seen that first, it's a false trust. Second, a false life. Now, thirdly, a false worship. This third thing that makes religion false is a misdirected, a false worship. I'll read from verse 17. God says to Jeremiah, "Do you not see what they're doing in the towns of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem? The children gather wood, the fathers light the fire, and the women knead the dough and make cakes to offer to the Queen of Heaven." Now, don't forget who this message is being preached to. It's not to Canaanite pagans who you would expect to be worshipping a pagan god. It's to Israelites who are currently on their way to the temple to worship Yahweh. But it turns out from these verses that it's not Yahweh alone that they worship. They're also worshipping a pagan goddess called the Queen of Heaven. Now, for Israel's neighbors, the Queen of Heaven was the wife of the high god, and she was probably a fertility goddess, meaning that people thought if they made offerings to her, in return she would grant them fertility, whether it was children or crop success or money. So the Israelites are syncretists, right? They're worshipping Yahweh, they're also worshipping a pagan goddess. What about us? If you're an outsider, syncretism can be quite simple, quite easy to spot. Let me tell you a story of when I was an outsider, when I was serving as a lecturer in a Bible college in Southeast Asia. One day in class, it was an Old Testament class, and we were looking at animal sacrifice in the Old Testament. One of my students put his hand up and said, "Should we do animal sacrifices in our churches today?" Now, I knew that this student came from a village where the traditional animistic religion involved offering animal sacrifices, pigs and chickens, to the ancestors for protection and blessing. So when he asked that question, I asked him a question back and I said, "Why do you ask?" And he said, "Well, in my church, people do sacrifice chickens and pigs on the front steps of the church." And I said, "Why do they do that?" And he said, "To secure blessing from the spirits of our ancestors. If you want your business to thrive, if you want your child to be healthy, you bring along a chicken and sacrifice it at the church." Now that's syncretism. And if you're an outsider, syncretism is often easy to spot. I was an outsider there. I didn't grow up with people around me seeking to get their needs met through chicken sacrifices. I didn't feel any pull, any temptation to do that. So I was able as an outsider to sit back and say, that is syncretism. Maybe we feel the same way with the Israelites here. We haven't grown up with Canaanite neighbours offering cakes to the Queen of Heaven to secure prosperity. We've probably never felt the temptation to do that. So we can sit back objectively and say, oh, that is syncretism. Obviously syncretism. How silly of them not to notice it. But what are people in our culture, what are people in the culture you've grown up in, do to secure prosperity and to ward off trouble? Have you ever asked someone from another culture to yours where they think you're syncretistic, where they think we're syncretistic? Would you dare ask that question? See, all false worship, all idolatry is an attempt to deal with our anxieties and our fears. It's an attempt to get our needs met by looking in the wrong place, by looking to false gods to provide what we should be looking to God for. And when we're the insiders, when it's in our culture, the false worship can actually be harder to spot, and the temptation to do it can be much stronger. See, the syncretist says, I trust you, God, but I'm going to hedge my bets and also trust the Queen of Heaven. The syncretist says, I trust you, God, but I'm also going to see if this pig sacrifice helps me. The syncretist says, I trust you, God, but I also trust you, Mammon, O God, that secures my future through savings and superannuation and investment and insurance. Here's where I get my needs met. I trust you, God, but I also trust you, hedonism, O God, that promises pleasure, entertainment, experiences. Here is where I will find true happiness. I trust you, God, but I also vigorously pursue status, O God, that demands ever-increasing achievement, success, and workaholism. Here is my path to confidence and self-worth. Just because we're not making cake offerings or chicken sacrifices doesn't mean there's no false worship going on. And Jeremiah 7's warning to us is, that is false religion. Flee from it. What makes false religion false? First, a false trust. Second, a false life. Third, a false worship. And now fourth, a false heart. I remember once some years ago when I was at a playground with my kids, there was a dad who was getting increasingly exasperated with the older of his two boys. David, don't push your brother. David, don't throw things at your brother. David, don't trip your brother. And eventually it boiled over in sarcasm and he said, David, why don't you just push your brother into the river then? At that point, I sensed things weren't going to go well for David. And sure enough, the father grabbed David and playtime was over. And what that dad said to David is kind of like what God says to the Israelites in verse 21. Go ahead, add your burnt offerings to the other sacrifices and eat the meat yourselves. See, the meat of the burnt offerings was not supposed to be eaten. It was never supposed to be eaten under God's holy law. It was to be wholly devoted to the Lord. So this verse is actually shocking. God is saying, go ahead, eat it for all I care. He's saying those sacrifices, they're meaningless. They're so meaningless that I no longer care even if you do them right, do them how I told you to do them. Why have they become so meaningless? Because they're being offered with a false heart. They're being offered unrelationally. And so what God does next is he takes the Israelites back to the beginning, verse 22. He says, for when I brought your ancestors out of Egypt and spoke to them, I did not just give them commands about burnt offerings and sacrifices, but I gave them this command. Obey me and I will be your God and you will be my people. If you want to understand what true religion is all about, go back to the beginning. Did I tell the Israelites, just do this sacrifice, just do this ritual? Is that all I said to them? No, says God. I said, obey me that we might have relationship. I'll be your God. You will be my people. That there in verse 23, that's the essence of true religion, relationship. But Israel squandered it. Verse 24, they did not listen or pay attention. Instead, they followed the stubborn inclinations of their evil heart. God desired relationship. Israel spurned it. God called for obedience. Israel ignored. They followed the evil intentions of their hearts. And so what we see here is that at the heart of the problem of false religion is the problem of a false heart, a false unrelational heart. And so sacrifice without a heart that turns to God in relationship, it's meaningless. What makes false religion false? It's a false trust, a false life, a false worship, and a false heart. What has God been saying to each of us through this warning text today? Has this exposé of false religion exposed false religion, even traces of it, in our own hearts, in our own lives? If it has, what do we do about that? We know from verse 3 that the response God desires to this warning is change. He says, reform your ways and your actions. What might that look like if we are going to pursue that kind of change in our own day, in our own new covenant situation? I want to finish with three short and tangible steps that we might make if we have found traces of false religion in our hearts today. Turn from, turn to, lie down. One, turn from false religion. Let's get on our knees and repent, come to God in prayer and confess. Two, turn to Christ. Turn to Christ to receive the replacement that he offers. See, when we turn from false religion, we don't just want there to be a void. We don't just want there to be a vacuum there. We need something in its place. We need true religion, true worship in its place. And that is what Christ offers. In the place of all the falses of false religion that we've looked at today, Christ offers us something true and new and good in its place. A new trust, a new life, a new worship, a new heart. He empowers us to put our trust in the right place, in him. He empowers us for a life brimming with obedience. He empowers true worship. And he removes our heart of stone and he replaces it with a heart of flesh. When we turn to Christ continually, dependently, relationally, by his Spirit, he empowers true religion. Three, lie down in peace and safety. We started today with a picture of danger, a person who thinks they're safe when they're not. We finish today with a picture of peace and safety. When we turn from false religion, when we dependently turn to Christ, we can lie down in perfect, impenetrable safety, peace and safety, reveling in the sufficiency of what Christ does for us.